Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. I want to say a few words about the Palestinian Authority, sort of a general review of what it is and what it is able to accomplish in terms of governing the Palestinian people. The real question we have to ask ourselves is, how can we expect this Palestinian Authority to really do anything when it's sort of frozen in time? Last month, the Palestinian Authority head, Mahmoud Abbas, marked the 19th anniversary of his four-year term in office. The 19th anniversary of his four-year term. He was 88 years old now. He was elected president of the Palestinian Authority in 2005, in January of that year. And he was elected president shortly after the death of the predecessor, who was Yasser Arafat, the terrorist. And that was the last time, 2005, that Palestinians held a presidential election. The next election, the next presidential election, was scheduled for 2009, and it was canceled due to the power struggle between the Fatah faction, which is under Abbas, and the Hamas terrorist group, which is backed by Iran, and which eventually took over the whole area. The ongoing dispute between these two groups, Hamas and Fatah, began back in 2006 when Hamas won a majority of seats on the Palestinian Legislative Council. And this fight, this contention between the rival Palestinian parties, reached its peak during the summer of 2007 when Hamas seized full control of the Gaza Strip in a violent and bloody coup. As a result of Hamas takeover over the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians have also been unable to hold parliamentary elections since then, and that is 18 years ago. Now, in 2021, Abbas, who only rules in that part under control of Abbas and his people in the central part of Palestine, of Israel, Abbas finally agreed in 2021 to hold a general election. And the reason he agreed to this was tremendous pressure by the Europeans and the Union and the U.S. on the Palestinian leadership. The Europeans and the Americans were hoping that new elections would mark the beginning of a process to reform the Palestinian Authority and pave the way for the emergence of new, younger leaders. Their hopes, however, were dashed when Abbas, in April 2021, just 2 years ago, decided to call off the elections. They were overdue by 18 years, but he decided to call them off again. Now, many Palestinians, of course, were not surprised. In fact, they had predicted that the Palestinian president would eventually cancel a vote out of fear of losing to Hamas. So the Fatah faction, which is under Abbas, was and remains deeply divided itself, especially after some candidates announced their intention to run in independent slots. The Fatah infighting meant that Hamas was certain to score another victory in the parliamentary election, just as they did in 2006. In other words, if there'd be an election, Hamas would take over. So the Palestinian leadership's failure to hold general elections for the past two decades is an indication of its failure to comply with pressure from Western donors to embark on major political, financial, administrative reforms. In other words, it's a solid indication that the Palestinian Authority is incapable of evolving into anything. Now, it's true that the Palestinian Authority and Abbas is considered less corrupt than during the Arafat era, mainly due to Western demands for increased accountability. But like Arafat, Abbas has also ruled as an autocrat, a dictator, and refused to share power with others. These are the facts on the ground. As a matter of fact, just a few years ago, in 2018, Abbas went as far as dissolving the Palestinian Legislative Council, and he turned himself into the chief Palestinian lawmaker, issuing hundreds of what he called presidential decrees that were essentially the laws. Moreover, he also displayed zero tolerance towards political rivals and critics, and he punished them by cutting off their salaries or fired them entirely. Abbas has expelled a number of Fatah leaders who dared to challenge his leadership, including a whole pile of them. Some of Palestinian Authority's biggest supporters may be surprised to learn that Abbas himself imposed economic sanctions on the Gaza Strip in 2018 because he tried to undercut Hamas, but it didn't work. Now, what's happened over the last couple months is Joe Biden, the President of the U.S., and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and other senior U.S. administration officials have been touting the idea of handing the Gaza Strip over to the Palestinian Authority after Hamas is removed from power in the Gaza Strip. The Biden administration, nonetheless, has pretty much acknowledged that the Palestinian Authority in its current structure cannot be entrusted with managing the affairs of the Gaza Strip. So the Gaza Strip is under Hamas. There's a war there now. The Palestinian Authority, as it were, rules the Palestinians in the central part of the country, but they're rotten and they're corrupt. So the Western countries like the United States are talking about, they use the word, a revitalized Palestinian Authority. So you have to ask yourself an interesting question. What does a revitalized Palestinian Authority mean? If the Americans are expecting the Palestinians to hold general elections in the upcoming weeks or months, they will be sorely disappointed. If they believe that Abbas and his team in Ramallah are going to wake up one morning and make a 180-degree turn and introduce real changes to the Palestinian governing bodies, they are very gravely mistaken. Abbas wants to maintain a tight grip on the Palestinian Authority, and he is well aware that democratic, economic, administrative reforms would undermine his standing and empower his political rivals and his opponents. Furthermore, Abbas is also aware of the public opinion polls that have consistently shown that 70-80% of Palestinians demand that he resign. It's also unrealistic to expect the Palestinian Authority president to get rid of a whole bunch of corrupt officials, most of which belong to his own inner circle. Such a move would undoubtedly spark a revolt against him by all his loyalists, if you can call them loyalists. At best, Abbas could initiate cosmetic changes like appointing a new prime minister or reshuffling the cabinet. The question is whether such measures would satisfy the Biden administration. That's the real problem. Now, it goes without saying that a revitalized Palestinian Authority must not merely hold general elections and get rid of incompetent and corrupt officials. That is not enough to enable it to successfully rule the Gaza Strip. They can hardly rule the central part of Israel now, where they control. Actually, they remain in power there because the Israeli army protects them. Rather, the focus should be on ending anti-Israel incitement, as well as all this education, which is geared toward terrorism, and the glorification of terrorism. That is what is happening in the Palestinian Authority. Anyone who kills a Jew is considered a hero, and his family gets paid. So the Palestinian Authority is rotten to the core. Now they're talking, the Biden administration is talking about the Palestinian Authority taking over Gaza after Hamas is destroyed. But the Palestinian Authority itself is just a corrupt outfit. So, truth of the matter is, in this regard, the Palestinian leadership can learn a lot from the United Arab Emirates. The United Arab Emirates is a country whose leaders are visionaries. From day one, took it upon themselves to promote tolerance, coexistence, and inclusion. Today, the United Arab Emirates is regarded as a symbol of moderate, forward-looking Arabs and Muslims who are deeply invested in promoting peace and securing a better future for the benefit of all. That's why those who are calling for a revamped Palestinian Authority would be advised to invite the UAE to play a bigger role in leading efforts to bring peace and stability to the Middle East. The United Arab Emirates policies and measures since the signing of the Abraham Accords in 2020 have shown that peace between Jews and Arabs is not only possible, but they actually celebrate it. Who would have thought that Jews would be able to walk around freely in an Arab country without having to conceal their identity? Who would have believed that the day would come when Jews would be publicly celebrating Hanukkah and Purim? For example, they have Hanukkah proudly displayed on the streets of Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Would it have occurred to anyone that Jews and Arabs could gather around a table to enjoy a Shabbat meal together or stand side by side on Holocaust Memorial Day? The Palestinian leaders, sadly, nowhere near the following in the footsteps of the UAE leadership, or for that matter, any form of acceptance for coexistence alongside the Jewish state. The Palestinian Authority does not require revitalization. It requires a total change. Whether such a change can come about, it's really hard to predict. The bottom line, everything depends on education. All those who have been educated under the Palestinian Authority since they were brought back from Tunisia have been trained and educated, indoctrinated and brainwashed to hate Jews and believe that the state of Israel has no right to exist. And now anything to change that, it'll take another 30 years, perhaps, of educating the next generation. So if the Palestinian Authority were to take over the Gaza Strip after Hamas is destroyed, the one thing is for sure, that the Israelis will have to control the education system under the Palestinian Authority. As long as they educate the way they've been doing, then this is a never-ending struggle. It's only by educating the next, not just one generation, but I think two generations at least. So maybe 30 years from now, we can start thinking about letting the Palestinian Authority run itself. Until that time, at least the educational part of it has to be run by the Israeli authorities. Otherwise, it'll be a never-ending round of wars. So what I tried to do in the last few minutes is give the listeners a review of what's happened since Arafat and his gang of terrorists were brought back from North Africa. And if the only hope for anything in the future As long as those Arabs are going to be here, you can't get rid of them. You're going to have to change your educational system, and that'll take 30 years as a minimum. So I just wanted to share that with the listeners, my thinking, the possibility for the future of Gaza. Right now, first thing we have to do is get rid of Hamas. Of course, we have a problem also in the north with Hezbollah, but that's another subject. What I tried to do in the last few minutes was give the listeners an idea of what has to be done after they kick Hamas out of Gaza, what has to be done to the educational system. If all those Arabs are going to stay there, they got to be educated very differently than they've been educated for the last 30 years. I want to say a couple words about this generation. Just a general statement. For us to succeed in meeting the military, the social, and political challenges that have piled up on the national agenda, urgent civil action has to be taken. There has to be a restoration of Israel society's trust in the country's leadership. That is a major problem now. I believe that there's simply not enough trust in this government. As of today, according to the surveys, only 35% of the public trust the government, while some 75% trust the commanders of the Israeli Defense Force. This is a narrow and shaky support base that will make difficult to take the consequential decisions that are facing us. The entire political system, both coalition and opposition, must come to their senses and close the trust gap. And the only way to close the trust gap with the public is through concrete action. We have to restore Israel's trust in the state's leadership. There must be a change, I think, in the current coalition. And the burden actually falls on the Knesset members now, the coalition and the opposition. We have to ask the members of Knesset to rise to the occasion and act in the national interest. The spirit of our army in Gaza and on the Lebanon border should also fill the Knesset. We have to have a change. Not so much in the political system and not so much in the politicians, but the way the politicians think. And of course, I believe there should be a change in the electoral system, but that's a story unto itself. Right now, we have a government that doesn't really get respect from the people, and that is something that cannot continue. Doesn't bode well for the future of Israel. I'll be back after the break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Bentekoen. Each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about something that gets very little attention, but it's going, I believe, to become a major problem. I'm talking about the fact there is a fifth column of Islamism in the United Kingdom. There are weekly mass demonstrations in London in support of the Palestinians in the Gaza war, and it has acquired significance beyond the specific context of British foreign policy. The United Kingdom it's not as great a power it was 100 years ago, but it is a middle-sized European power. It has very little influence on the Middle East in general, and absolutely no influence whatsoever on the Israeli or Hamas decision-making. Demands for a ceasefire now on the streets of London will therefore produce nothing on the ground in the Middle East. However, these demonstrations in London are significant and that they showcase the arrival in Britain, in British public life, of a new political force, which is a mass Islamist-led street presence that seeks to enforce its will on the public space and intimidate its opponents. In late February, the presence of an Islamist mob outside Parliament forced the Speaker of the House to change parliamentary procedure out of concern for the physical safety of members of Parliament in a debate on calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. The opposition leader warned that the Labour MP's security was at risk should they be seen as abstaining or opposing a motion calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Contrary to convention, and with hundreds of protesters outside the Parliament, the Speaker permitted a Labour amendment softening the language calling for a ceasefire, enabling Labour members to vote for a motion and thus avoid the hostile attention of this mob outside Parliament. The Speaker later justified his decision by saying the following: "The details of the things that have been brought to me are absolutely frightening on all members of the House. I have a duty of care, and I say that if I make a mistake, I'm looking after the members. I am guilty of a mistake, but I must worry about the safety of the members of Parliament." A journalist in the Mail on Sunday newspaper later said to noted that I had spoken to a member of Parliament who told me he had weighed up on his own physical safety when deciding on how to vote on the Gaza motion. According to him, they have crossed a line. We are not a properly functioning democracy if this is a factor in how our elected representatives act. In other words, they voted in Parliament in a way because of fear of a mob of Islamists outside the Parliament. And that is not good news. The mother of parliaments is weakened and diminished as a result. The streets are being dominated by Islamic extremists, and members of Parliament and British Jews are too intimidated to walk through central London. And that is a very serious problem. Regarding the mob in question, the weekly demonstrations for Gaza, which have temporarily taken over central London regularly, attract upwards of 250,000 people, a quarter of a million people on a regular basis. There's all kind of organizations involved, and two of these organizations have links or are supportive of Hamas. There's something called the Muslim Association of Britain. There's several others. They all are supportive of terrorism. There's also a group called Friends of Al-Aqsa. And it's a group that it lives on hatred of Israel, campaigns for the elimination of Israel, denies the Jewish character and supports Hamas. And these are the people who are demonstrating outside the Mother of Parliaments in London. The on March 9th, for example, this combination of Islamists and far-left affiliations claimed that they had organized 400,000 people for this demonstration in central London. It could well be, according to observers, that 50% of the demonstrators were visibly Muslim, because many women were wearing hijabs, and they identified themselves as Muslims. The other 50% appeared to be white British leftists who were visibly older. There was all kind of organizations there, far left labor organizations and so forth. The main thing was, it was Islamists. The energy of the march, the chanting, the singing, all came from the Muslim community, the Muslim part of the march. Some of the chants were in Arabic, which would have passed the leftist elements by. They called for an Arab Palestine, and they said in Arabic, "My blood is Palestinian," and so forth. One protester was wearing body armor and carrying a riot shield along with a combat helmet adorned with a Palestinian flag. In another section of the march, a young female demonstrator wearing a black and white keffiyeh led a group of hijab women chanting, "It's right to rebel. U.S., U.K., go to hell." For Arab nationalists and Islamists, the Palestinian cause serves as a kind of sounding board, really. In the demonstrations in London, the cause appears to be a familiar one. The flags at the demonstration were Palestinian. By the way, this flag was originally designed by Sir Mark Sykes back at the time of the First World War as the banner of the Arab revolt against the Ottomans. But the underlying meaning of these marches is something else. It's the latest phase in an Islamist posing of the question of power on the streets of a major European city, London. Question is, whose will can be enforced? Whose rules must be obeyed? Who must bow before the threat of a superior force? These are very serious questions here at these demonstrations at the Mother of Parliaments. So the issue is really a very important one. This kind of mob will either be dispersed, or it may safely be assumed that it will continue to act to threaten and negate the will of elected representatives, thus eroding democratic governments in the United Kingdom. In other words, this is something that's pretty much under the headlines. You don't hear much about it. Matter of fact, you hardly hear anything about it. But there is an Islamic fifth column in the United Kingdom that is threatening the British democracy. Apparently at its very beginning, but if they can get 250,000 people to protest in front of Parliament and cause the members of Parliament to change their vote, that is an extremely serious thing. And it's pretty much under the headlines so far, but it shouldn't be. By the way, on the same subject, in the London Times 2 weeks ago, there was a column by a Muslim professor who teaches at Georgetown University in Washington. And he made an observation in the London Times that the Muslim Brotherhood may be banned in Mecca, in Saudi Arabia, but actually it thrives in London. This professor Hussein is a Muslim, Ed Hussein. He called for shutting the various arms of the Muslim Brotherhood operating in the United Kingdom, observing that it is a danger to British security and British democracy. Hamas is waging a war against Israel in the Gaza Strip. It's the Palestinian arm of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Hamas has vowed to act against Israel until it succeeds. Hamas has been designated as an international terrorist organization by the European Union. There has been a disturbing trend in the West to underestimate, to misjudge, and even to misrepresent Hamas and its parent organization. And the parent organization of Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood. They have a charter, has stated aims, And there, it says in their charter, jihad is our path, martyrdom is our aspiration. And that is what is happening in London. There's no reason to doubt that this would happen in other major European cities. By the way, there were big anti-Israel riots in the United States, but they didn't block off Congress, although they tried to understand. But right now, the challenge for the Israel in the West is Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement. An analysis was published in December last year about the October attacks in Israel in the Foreign Policy magazine. It was the article was entitled, "Could Hamas Become a Global Threat?" And the conclusion of Foreign Policy magazine that indeed Hamas could become a global threat. Hamas has its networks in Europe, United States. They have not been totally uprooted because Hamas networks have sometimes been coddled by well-connected political forces. So the truth of the matter is that there must be a two-pronged response to Hamas. First, you have Israel's military thrust, along with strong Western economic and political pressure. Ultimately, this must include a strike against Iran, according to those people who are so-called experts. One of the experts in the field is Dory Gold. He was Israel's ambassador to the United Nations and the director general of Israel's foreign ministry. And he claimed, he's a very serious person, he claims that ultimately that there has to be a potent strike against Iran, which has become the main ally of Hamas and other groups like Hamas. While the truth of Hamas's hostile intentions has been demonstrated again and again, particularly in the attacks in October, it has again been demonstrated that Hamas is not acting alone. Its actions would have been impossible without the strong backing of Iran, which has hovered behind Hamas's military initiatives. Therefore, contending with Hamas is not just a one-dimensional struggle of Israel against Hamas. It should be a combined effort of the Western world, because Hamas and people like Hamas are a threat to Western democracy, not just to Israel. And that is in the opinion, as I said, of Dory Gold, who's a person with a reputation. As I said, he was Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. He's someone who knows what's happening around the world. By the way, this also includes the United States. The Atlantic magazine had an essay called "The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending" by someone named Franklin Foyer. And he describes anti-Semitism in the United States now. And he talks about all the violent incidents, schools, universities, city councils, and public spaces in the United States, in which he detects an anti-Jewish pincer movement led by ultra-progressives on the left and old-school anti-Semites on the right. There was a study indicating that millions of Americans blamed the Jews for the 2008 financial meltdown, and there is a disconcerting number of Israel's critics denying the Jews' right to a nation of their own. There were 56 physical attacks on Jews and 554 acts of vandalism on Jewish locations recorded by the Anti-Defamation League in the 3 months following the October 7th massacre, besides over 1,300 public events with anti-Semitic rhetoric and another 1,300 incidents of harassment, oral or written. So there's tremendous hostility now, and there's also a transforming social landscape underpinned by a deliberate institutional drive to re-engineer what's happening. They want to push the Jews aside. Post-war America, after the Second World War, canceled anti-Jewish discrimination and embraced an astonishing battery of Jewish celebrities. And the Jews were very popular after the Second World War, after 6 million Jews had been killed. It was a golden age of American Jewry. But it was an era defined by moral ideals and political norms that Jewish heritage inspired. Jewish thinkers articulated and Jewish masses embraced. I remember that. I grew up myself in that time. Now, it turns out things have changed, that this liberalism has been put aside by a society that's lost its capacity to express disagreements without resorting to animus. And that's a very tough comment about what's happening on the American scene. So in brief, in Europe, in the United States, Jews are not in the position they were as far back as after the Second World War. In my lifetime, the situation for Jews has changed around the world. If anything, it's bad for Jews, it's bad for Western civilization, not just for the Jewish state. And that apparently is what's happening right now. I'll be back. I don't like to end by a portion of the program on a sad note, but I think this is the reality. I'll be back after the break.
Hi, everyone. This is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together, we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
In a previous segment of this program, I discussed about what's happening in the United Kingdom vis-a-vis the fact that there are a lot of Muslims there who are demonstrating against the government, even at the parliament. And after I did that segment of the program, I came across an item in the newspaper that I want to share with the listeners, because it turns out that the British government has unveiled a new definition of extremism in response to this eruption of hate crimes since October 7th, particularly against Jews. Earlier this month, Prime Minister Sunak warned that Britain's multi-ethnic democracy was being undermined by both Islamist and far-right extremists. And he mentioned that all kind of anti-Semitic incidents, they rose quite a bit this year, and the British government is concerned about it. So he said that, and I quote, our democracy and our values of inclusivity and tolerance are under challenge from extremist groups who are radicalizing our young people and driving greater polarization. So critics say it could be counterproductive, they're using this new law to silence those who disagree with the government. Now, it turns out that concern has been voiced by really well-known figures in England, ranging from the Archbishop of Canterbury and the former Conservative government ministers. The definition apparently would not embrace gender-critical campaigners, those with conservative religious views, or transgender activists, or environmental campaigners. The government said that it's important to stress we're in no way intending to restrict freedom of expression religion, or belief. However, this new definition states that extremism is, and I quote, "extremism is the promotion or advancement of an ideology based on violence, hatred, or intolerance that aims to destroy fundamental rights and freedoms, undermine or replace the United Kingdom's liberal parliamentary democracy, or intentionally create an environment for others to achieve those results." Now, it's true that Britain already bans groups that says are involved in terrorism, and supporting or being a member of these organizations is a criminal offense. The Palestinian terrorist group Hamas is among 80 proscribed international organizations in Great Britain. So the government will not provide funding to any of these groups that it considers to be criminal, but currently no groups have been officially defined as extremists using the former definition, but now they have a new definition. In other words, because of the rise of extremism in Great Britain, particularly from Islamists, they have changed the definition of what extremism is, and they've broadened the definition. So this is what's happening in Great Britain, and we'll have to follow up on it and see what the effect is on public discourse in Great Britain. And since I'm talking about public discourse and education is part of public discourse, so I want to bring something else. A new report has become available by the Institute for Monitoring Peace and Cultural Tolerance in School Education. It's known by its initials, IMPACT-SE. And they found perpetuation of gender-based biases in Palestinian Authority textbooks, including stigmas regarding women's mental capability, women's leadership skills, and women's sexual behavior. So it turns out, as I see it, according to this report by this organization called IMPACT, that the Palestinian Authority doesn't only propagandize against Jews, it also propagandizes against women. They did a report and they examined 13 textbooks for the last couple of years, and they were looking for gender equality. The Palestinian Ministry of Education announced several years ago that they would educate for gender equality. According to this report, despite intentions to eliminate discrimination, persistent gender biases were identified, especially in Islamic education materials, which often portray women as inferior and emphasize traditional roles, albeit with some acknowledgement of their role in national efforts. In other words, the educational system under the Palestinian Authority pretty much looks down upon women. And this report finds that the curriculum presents an uneven picture of gender equality with an inconsistent approach evident in the contrasting depictions of women, from upholding traditional roles to glorifying participation in national resistance against Israel, including the problematic celebration of female terrorists as icons. In other words, the educational system under the Palestinian Authority celebrates women who kill themselves in order to kill Jews. So that's what goes on in the Palestinian educational system. this depiction of women and gender roles diverges from the UNESCO standards, and there are also apparently international gender equality treaties that are ratified by different countries. It's something I never heard about before. And apparently these gender equality treaties have been ratified by the Palestinian Authority itself. So there's a significant gap between Palestinian Authority educational policies and global benchmarks. So it sort of raises questions about the impact of international support and funding aimed at fostering gender equality in Palestinian education. So it's interesting, by the way. I looked at this report, and there are multiple countries in the Middle East that have pretty much made great strides improving school curriculum. However, when it comes to the Palestinian Authority, whose curriculum, by the way, is also taught by UNRWA and Hamas, there are two main issues, namely the encouragement of violence and anti-Semitism, and his discriminatory views toward women. So in the Palestinian Authority education, there are three things that stand out, apparently. The encouragement of violence, the hatred of Jews, and discriminatory views toward women. This stands out in the education that the Palestinian kids are getting. So what it does is it forces an environment of sexual violence, particularly against Jewish women, is normalized. And now we saw what happened on October 7th. The people who reviewed this book, a gentleman named Chef, Marcus Chef, who's the CEO of this Impact, which evaluates these educational systems, he said that generations have been taught to cut the necks of Israelis, that Jews should be annihilated, and dying is better than living. They're showing descriptions of violence against Israelis. They learn that jihad is the highest peak of Islam. So this encouragement to revenge against Jewish women in particular is exemplified by the Islamic education system, which teaches that Jews have sexually harassed Muslim women. And it goes on. In other words, the kids are actually taught to sexually assault Jewish women. They're also taught that men are wiser than women. Full gender equality is an injustice. And equality of the sexes is called a biological lie. Women aren't to blame for men's sexual harassment because temptation mostly comes from women. So you have here in the Palestinian educational system, I don't know about other Arab countries, but in the Palestinian educational system, you have a fusion of anti-Semitism, encouragement of violence, gender-based blood libels, and discriminatory views toward women. This is taught to thousands of Palestinian children. So once you see the education that these kids are getting, it offers a window into how it's possible for terrorists to systematically weaponize extreme sexual violence against Jewish women in the attack on October 7th, because they've been educated that way. And also, it's noted in this report that Norway, Finland, Germany, Ireland, and other nations that support the Palestinian education system and allow gender disparities to be school curriculum, these countries are reviewing what the Palestinians are teaching their kids and deciding whether or not they're going to continue to support it. So it's a bad system. This is the way kids are taught. You can see how these people acted against women on October 7th because they've been educated that way. Something you find it hard to believe in a normal Western society. They've been educated to attack and degrade women. That is part of their education. It's a terrible thing to take note of, but apparently this impact organization found out that it's true. So this explains a lot of what goes on within the Palestinian Authority. Very shameful, but apparently very true. And it's something that most people apparently didn't know anything about, but it turns out it is indeed a fact. By the way, I take note of the fact that although there have been plenty of examples of Israel's enemies slandering Israel with false accusations of human rights violations, Israel's record has shown it to be exceptional at providing all those under Israel's control with human rights every human being deserves. Israel went over and above its international requirements by providing Israeli citizenship to the Arabs who are citizens within Israel's borders, and granting them not only human rights, but equal rights with every other Israeli citizen, including a right to an education. That is what Israel has done for its Arab citizens. Now, interestingly enough, the Palestinians under Israel's control, whether in Gaza now, before Israel withdrew back in 2005, or in Judea and Samaria today, are not Israeli citizens. They don't live in Israel officially, but they're granted every human right they deserve. Israel's just treatment of Palestinians is in direct contradiction to other Arab countries' treatment of Palestinians. The Palestinians living in Syria and other Arab countries do not get there, or Jordan, for example, are treated as second-class citizens. Palestinians living under Israeli control are treated very humanly. So Israel's enemies have tried to make it look like Israel is mistreating the Arabs. It's not true. From the very founding of the State of Israel, and even before its founding, Zionists have never expressed a desire or a strategy of wiping out the Palestinian people. This, by the way, is in direct contrast to Hamas's call since its founding for the destruction of Israel and all Zionists and the killing of Jews. Israel is concerned with its own security, not with destroying another people. Now, the modern day Israel and its people always stayed true to this vision. Israel has signed peace and normalization deals with six Arab countries and are apparently eager to sign more as soon as possible. Israel treats the Arabs fairly, better than most of the Arabs treat the Arabs. These are the facts on the ground, and we have to keep repeating them in order to fight against the propaganda that says otherwise. I'll be back after the break.
Be smart. Listen to Israel News Talk Radio in the background while you work and get the latest news and commentary from Israel. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. We are approaching the holiday of Purim, and I want to say a few words about that holiday. The last two festivals to be added to the Jewish calendar prior to modern times were Purim and Hanukkah. And the truth of the matter is that both those holidays are festivals, actually, and they're both about anti-Semitism. In the Purim story, there is somebody who wanted to kill the Jews, and the same thing is true in the Hanukkah story. The Hanukkah story had a Greek general named Antiochus who wanted to kill Judaism, not so much the Jews. It was the difference between Nazi Germany and Soviet communism. Nazi Germany wanted to actually kill the Jews. Soviet communism wanted to kill Jewry. And Purim and Hanukkah are pretty much the same. Purim, our enemies wanted to kill the Jews. And in Hanukkah, they wanted to kill Judaism. So it's these two holidays have something in common to things that have happened in modern times. What saved Jews on Purim was a behind-the-scenes influence by the Queen Esther. She had influence in the royal court. But the danger of anti-Semitism remained even after they killed the enemies of the Jews. There's still a lot of people around who the Jews had to defend themselves against. What if hatred returned at this time and there was no Esther around to save the Jews? That's one reason, according to the Talmud, why we do not say Hallel on Purim, because anti-Semitism still remained after the Purim story was over. On Hanukkah, by contrast, the Jews fought back and won. The heroes were the Maccabees, and it became a symbol of Jewish activism, of refusing to live in fear. As a symbol of this, the original custom was to light Hanukkah lights outside the front door of the house, or at least in a window facing the street, to publicize the miracle. Today we see the lighting of giant menorahs in the most prominent public face of cities throughout the world. Although this year it might be problematic. Hanukkah tells us not to curse the darkness, but instead to bring light into the world. However, we have a very serious problem now because I believe that darkness has returned. It returned likewise in virtually every country in Europe. This should happen. Within living memory of the Holocaust, what happened in my lifetime. The Holocaust was the most systematic attempt ever made by civilization to find a cure for the virus of the world's longest hate, anti-Semitism. More than a half a century of Holocaust education and anti-racist legislation has apparently not done the job, particularly traumatic that this has happened in the United States, a country where Jews felt more at home than anywhere else in the world. So what's happening now? Well, I'm not an expert, but I see some things I want to share with the listeners. First, because of everything associated with the internet, with smartphones and videos and social media, we have what has been called by Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks as a disinhibition effect. People are far more hateful when communicating electronically than when speaking face to face. That's something new, something totally new. Cyberspace has proved to be the most efficient incubator of resentment, rancor, and conspiracy theories ever invented. Anti-Semitism thrives on conspiracy theories. Versions of the blood libel and the protocols of the Elders of Zion have been updated now for the 21st century. Also, because the way people encounter these phenomena, people generally encounter the internet alone, in the privacy of their own home. This allows them to be radicalized without anyone realizing what's happening. Time and time again, we read of people carrying out horrific attacks, but those who knew them recall not having seen any warning signs that they were intent on committing any kind of evil attack. So now, the most dangerous phenomenon of our time is the lone wolf attack because it's so hard to predict. The internet is particularly dangerous for loners, people with whom the normal process of socialization, in other words, to learn how to live with others who are not like us, that has broken down in the modern age. Historically, though, the most important fact in the rise of anti-Semitism is a sense among a group of people that the world as it is now is not the way it used to be or ought to be. Somehow the Jews are blamed for things not being the way they would like them to be. The far left has never recovered so far from the global collapse of communism as an ideology. Communism and socialism both have gone down the drain. Hence, the assault on Jews is capitalists and libertarians. That's from the left. On the far right, feels threatened by changing composition of Western societies because of immigration on an unprecedented scale and their very low birth rates among native populations. Hence, what happens is you have white supremacists. Many radical Islamists are troubled by dysfunction in the Muslim world through the emergence of anti-Zionism as the new anti-Semitism. These concerns do not in and of themselves lead to anti-Semitism. There must be other factors. So you ask yourself, when bad things happen, good people ask, what did I do wrong? So they put their house in order. But bad people, when bad things happen, ask, who did this to me? They cast themselves as victims and search for scapegoats to blame. The scapegoat of choice has for 2,000 years been the Jews. They're the outsiders. For 1,000 years, they were the most prominent non-Christian minority in Europe. Today, the State of Israel is the most significant non-Muslim presence in the Middle East. So it's easy to blame Jews because they're conspicuous. They're a minority and because they are there. Anti-Semitism has little to do with Jews. They are its object, not its cause. And everything to do with dysfunction in the communities that harbor it. This was pointed out, by the way, very, very precisely by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. His expression is when people ask who did this to me, they look for scapegoats to blame. And therefore it's easy to blame Jews because they're conspicuous, they're a minority, and simply they are there and available as a target. Rabbi Sacks has pointed out something very important. Anti-Semitism, or any hate, becomes dangerous in any society when three things happen. When it moves from the fringes of politics to a mainstream party, and to its leadership, when the party sees its popularity with the general public is not harmed by anti-Semitism, and when those who stand up and protest are vilified and abused for doing so. These things have been pointed out by Rabbi Sacks, and they're true in all societies. Now, all these three factors exist today in Great Britain, something that we could not have predicted even 10 years ago. So we can't let the same thing happen in America. So what must be done to protect America from the growth of anti-Semitism? The first priority must be to strengthen security in Jewish areas, Jewish venues like synagogues, to intensify police patrols and to develop habits of vigilance. The British Jewish community has created something called the Community Security Trust, which with the support of government grants monitors risks, enlists thousands of volunteers to stand security duty, and works closely with the government and local police forces. Because what happens is people who hate Jews, lone wolves, I'm not talking about big organized anti-Semitic organization, lone wolves tend to seek soft targets, and the Jewish community must ensure as far as possible that there are no soft targets. Well, and the people have to remember that while the Jews have enemies, the Jews also have friends. It is important that non-Jews from all walks of life come to the support of the Jewish community. That's a very serious problem. Many surveys in the United States have shown that Jews are the most admired of all minorities. It's a very interesting thing. So Jews cannot fight anti-Semitism alone, because the victim can't cure the crime. The Jewish community has to make friends with whoever will stand with the Jewish community and help lead the fight against anti-Semitism. This is best done, I believe, by explaining how anti-Semitism endangers everyone, because the hate that begins with the Jews never ends with the Jews. These are the facts of life. Many parts of Jewish history are sad. They've been written in tears. However, the Jews have outlived every empire, every civilization that sought to destroy the Jews. We're coming upon Purim. There was an entire empire that controlled the known world at that time in its generation, most of the known world, and attempted to destroy the Jews, and we were saved with the help of God. So we really have to keep in mind that we're not alone. We have friends, and we have to see to it that our friends understand the problems that we face. By the way, things are getting a little bit more complicated now, just this week, because Israel is defending itself against those terrorists who struck us several months ago, and we're fighting in Gaza. But the American government, which started off being 100% behind us, is now showing signs of weakness, and apparently a lot of it has to do with the fact that the American presidential election is coming up this year, and there are a lot of Arabs who are anti-Semites, they hate Jews, and who have large populations in several of the big states in the United States. And the American president is beginning to kowtow to them because he wants their vote. And the way the system is set up in the United States with the Electoral College, it's important to win the vote, not the total vote, but the vote of each state. And there are states where the Muslim population may decide, probably will decide, who's going to win that state. So that's what's happening with the American president now. So he's turning away from the support that he began with Israel. So we have a serious problem. And unfortunately, just this week, it turns out that one of the Jewish leaders in the Senate of the United States spoke against our prime minister. One tends to believe that his speech might have been even approved by the American president. That's the first time it's happened that a Senate leader or an important Jew in the United States Senate would turn publicly and pretty viciously against our prime minister. We are facing a critical period, and hopefully we'll be able to pull out the, as I said, the message of Purim is we have to fight back, never be afraid. We have to take pride and get others to join us in our defense. This is no doubt an extremely difficult time approaching the American election when the American president, who's been pro-Israel for most of his career, is now worrying about the Electoral College, and therefore he's starting to back off from his support of Israel. And it's something that's just happened within the last couple of weeks, actually. And it's our job to see to it that this really doesn't harm us. So it's really a critical time right now. Hopefully, our leadership of the Jewish community in the United States and here in Israel will know how to handle what is a growing problem on the American scene. So I don't want to paint a black picture, but I'm trying to paint a realistic picture. This is a difficult year. We're fighting a real war in Gaza, and we'll probably have to fight a political war in the United States to see to it that the Americans remain supportive of us. It's a tough situation, but we've been in tough situations before. I just tried to give a picture of what's happening now. I'll be back after the break.
Warning. Take cover. The Jewish Truth Bomb is here. The show that will explode all the false narratives and fake news. Join host Lenny Goldberg each week as he wires the news together and detonates it through biblical verses that will deliver a shockwave that will blow you away. Don't miss it. The Jewish Truth Bomb. Every Monday.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. Leo D., he's a rabbi. He's an educator. He lives in Efrat, south of Jerusalem. And he's written quite a bit. And it turns out that his wife, Lucy, and daughters, Maya and Rina, were murdered by terrorists in April 2023, before the present war. So he is, of course, a supporter of settlement. And I want to paraphrase some things that he said, because they're things that I have on my mind also, and he says them in a much better way than I do. Before October 7th, he writes, there's a widely held view in Israel and around the world that the area called the West Bank, that we call Judea and Samaria, was unjustly settled by Israel following the 1967 Six-Day War. He writes that many people believe that these Israeli settlements and the settlers living in them were responsible for the hatred of Palestinians toward Jews. They argued that evacuating these new settlements and exchanging land for peace was the correct way to bring peace to our region here. And then October 7th happened. Besides the shock that Palestinians were able to break through billions of dollars of security equipment and surprise Israel's entire intelligence and military apparatus, apparently the greatest shock of all was that the attack came from Gaza and not from the so-called West Bank, and it targeted Israel proper rather than just targeting the settlements. Surely the Gazans, who had had independence for almost 20 years, and keep in mind, in 2005, almost 10,000 Jews were evacuated, who were living in Gush Katif, to bring the Palestinians back from North Africa, and yet they still hate us. After all, they've enjoyed self-rule and actually billions of dollars of foreign aid since the disengagement back in 2005, and they have UNRWA-funded schools and Qatar-funded mosques and hospitals. Had the attack come from the Palestinians in the West Bank, who clearly must hate Israel's settlers who live side by side with them, this would have been a clear message to the world that we need to end the settler enterprise and give back the stolen land to the Palestinians. But what happened was it shattered all the paradigms once and for all. We had given Gaza to them. They could have made an independent state there, but they used it instead as a basis for attacking Israel. By attacking Israeli kibbutzim and launching missile attacks in Ashdod, in Ashkelon, in Tel Aviv, the Gazans made something very clear. What they made clear is that they regard all of Israel as their West Bank and every Israeli, no matter where he lives, as a settler. So the Palestinians and their supporters have been calling for a Palestinian state from the river to the sea for many decades, a term that defines the entire state of Israel as their rightful homeland. And they're calling for it not only here. They call for it on the streets of the United States. They call for it from the river to the sea on universities in the United States. So, in a sense, they believe that the state of Israel is their rightful homeland. So, in a sense, in their eyes, all of Israel are settlers. There's no difference to Hamas or to the Arab terrorists of any kind of Israeli, no matter where you live, because we're all living in land that they think belongs to them. So the biblical homeland, Yehuda and Judea and Samaria, which in Hebrew is called Yehuda v'Shomron, and we, those of us who live there, and I lived there for quite a few years. I have a daughter who lives there. They're refuted by the short for the Hebrew word. They say Yosh stands for Yehuda and Shomron. The term West Bank was reserved for the old paradigm thinkers, along with foreign journalists and politicians, to describe the land immediately to the west of Jordan they believe was rightfully Palestinian. The Arabs look upon all of Israel as the West Bank, that they actually belongs to them. Now, it's interesting, by the way, the American government, the American administration, and the British government recently rescinded the rights of certain settlers to enter the USA or to Britain in order to draw some sort of false moral equivalence between Palestinians who rape and behead children and a small number of extremist settlers who very rarely engage in arson or throwing stones. There are very few Jewish extremists who attack Arabs. Very few. Clearly, they have not noticed that a dramatic change in Israel identity, because the Arabs now always have defined all the Israelis as settlers, because they believe the entire land belongs to them. A recent poll shows that 65% of Israelis no longer believe in a two-state solution. This poll was taken after the present war began. Now, over the years, by the way, those who don't believe in a two-state solution is rising, but since the war began several months ago, the numbers are really going up. Those Israelis who do support a Palestinian state are a very, very small minority, and they're shrinking every day because of the ongoing hostage situation and the anger over the brutality of what was done to these Jews in the last couple of months. With no serious political party advocating a two-state solution today, because, of course, nobody wants to give the Palestinians an army, an air force, or open borders to Egypt and Jordan. So you could pretty much say the two-state solution is dead in the water, despite the fact that the American government has started talking about it again. So October 7th revealed many misunderstandings in Israeli life, including the mistaken belief that the settler movement was the cause of all the woes of the state of Israel. Now, the truth of the matter is today, all of the Israelis are behind the war against terrorism now. All the Israelis are united behind the war against Hamas, and we can say, in a sense, that we all live in the West Bank. So in that sense, every Israeli is a settler, according to the Hamas Information Bureau. So we have to look for a new paradigm to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that... there's not going to be a two-state solution. What happened was we saw them, we gave them their own possibility to make their own state. They turned it into a terrorist entity. And obviously we can't continue in that direction. I don't know what the solution is going to be after this war is over. But it certainly is not going to be a two-state solution. There are people who have come up with other solutions. There's a lot of them are very complicated. They have to do with turning various Arab families to take over various parts of the Arab population. There's all kind of solutions, but they all can wait. The bottom line is we cannot allow another state to be created between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. What happened since October 7th proves that we cannot allow an independent Palestinian state to exist. It would be a danger, as it indeed so far is a danger now, to the existence of the state of Israel and to Jews living here. I don't know what the solution is. Take smarter minds than mine, but it's not going to be a two-state solution. You cannot allow the Arabs to have their own state. In a previous portion of the program, I said something about U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, but I want to say a few more words about it because it really bothers me. Senator Schumer, speaking in the Senate, took the privilege of rank and for 48 minutes spoke against Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu, calling him one of the four major obstacles to peace, and urged us here living in Israel to remove our duly elected government. The truth of the matter is, from a parliamentary perspective, he should have been ruled out of order by the Senate president as soon as he began his talk, because there is no motion of substance on the floor of the Senate at the time. Apparently, he got the permission of the American president to speak against the Israeli prime minister. Now, there are a lot of arguments in favor of a new government in Israel. A lot of us are not happy with the present government. But it's insulting for the majority leader of the U.S. Senate to say that what he did about the democratically elected government of Israel, which is an ally of the United States, it's never proper to attempt to interfere with the internal governance of an ally. And by the way, senators from both sides of the aisle spoke out against Schumer afterwards. They felt that he was out of place in making his statement. It's interesting that Schumer probably chose to bring this up because he's the highest Jewish elected official in the history of the United States. He's a majority leader of the American Senate. However, that does not give him any right to make the remarks that he did. The truth of the matter is just the opposite. Given his position, of which Jews can be proud, his obligation is not to play on his faith, the fact that he's Jewish. It's interesting, you know, he's a senator in the United States Senate. He should act as a senator and speak as a senator and not act as a Jew. The members of the worldwide Jewish community do not need someone to arrogate themselves the right to dictate what kind of a government we should have here in Israel, how we should conduct our response to the massacre of October 7th, or when we should hold elections. By the way, everyone apparently wondered whether Schumer was speaking in the name of President Joe Biden. After all, people in public office know that they give up their right to private opinions, as anything they say or do will be assumed to reflect the policy of the organization they represent. Initially, apparently, the White House said they were aware that Schumer was going to do this, but they were not involved in the preparation of the speech itself. Anyhow, it was disappointing to hear what Schumer said and to hear what the President Biden said, because President Biden, as I mentioned in a previous portion of this program, is busy seeking Muslim votes in the states in the upcoming election. Look, everyone believes that the elected officials of any country have to make decisions that they believe are in the best interests of the government that they represent. In the case of the American relationship with Israel, not everything that's good for the U.S. will necessarily be good for Israel, and not everything good for Israel is good for the United States. It's something we have to accept. We also do not expect elected officials in the United States who are Jewish to always agree with what we are doing here because it's a Jewish state. However, the Jewish community has no need for someone to rise to say lofty position as the majority leader in the Senate and then use that position to dictate what we here in Israel should be doing. So the senator was very wrong in what he did. And I bring it up again because it's the first time something like this has ever happened. And he really stepped out of line. He rose in the Senate of the United States and told Israel how to conduct its politics. You don't do that. That is not the way you treat an ally. So he carries a lot of weight. He's the speaker. He's the majority leader in the Senate. And he's also Jewish. But he used that both to take issue with our government, and something you simply can't do. Anyhow, I'm sorry I had to bring that up again. Some very weighs heavily on me because the first time something like that ever happened. It's one thing for someone who's a public opinion leader or a commentator to comment, but for someone to rise in the Senate of the United States and say harsh comments about the government of the state of Israel, and in particular the prime minister, that is simply wrong. So it's something that bothered me quite a bit, and that's why I brought it up again. At any rate, that's enough for this week. Thank you very much for listening, And until next time, this is Jay Shapiro signing off.
Straight Talk from Israel. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.